Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 6th, 2015. Welcome to episode 115 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and sometimes it's about podcasting. I am your host, Mr. Rourke. No, I am your host, Jack Nutting, and today we have our esteemed selection of round table sitters, starting with Earl Evans. How are you doing today, Earl?
I'm doing very well, Jack. Thank you. The weather here in Portland is rainy. And that's to be expected from now until March, I guess. So how are you doing, sir? Does your attitude match your latitude?
Hard to say. I think my attitude is pretty good right now, but my latitude, I don't know. We don't have any sort of nice wintry weather in Stockholm as we should. We have just sort of rainy, kind of cold, crappy weather. Actually, it wasn't that cold. The weird thing is, today in Stockholm, the temperature was the same as it was midsummer in the middle of June. So that is crazy. I don't know what's going on.
Wow.
Weird stuff. But there is no climate change going on. The science is still out on that. Everybody, calm down. On the East Coast, however, we have Paul Hagstrom, who can surely tell us about weather in Boston, which is probably also terrible.
Actually, it isn't, but hello, thanks, hi. it's weird. It seems like spring out. I always like it when it gets cold and then warms up a little bit, even in the run-up to winter, because I have this brief moment where I feel like, it's over. Of course, it doesn't last, but...
And in the Southern Hemisphere, we have Michael Mulhern, who can tell us about the whole opposite range of temperatures happening down there. What's going on, Michael?
Yes, it's great down here, and definitely not winter. Yeah, we're just into summer here, so summer started, we do it by the calendar here, so on December 1, when summer started, it was 40 degrees Celsius out where I am, so that was a bit of a whack across the back of the head, weather and temperature-wise, but
sure.
Everything else is sort of now low 30s, high 20s, so it's actually, it's back to being wonderful.
Yep. All right, well, good. Well, we are heading into December. This is our first episode in December, but almost our last episode of the year. We'll have one more in a couple weeks, but we decided we'd start talking a little bit about how 2015 has been for us. And so the topic I want to discuss a little bit is what has been everyone's best or favorite retro computing purchase of the past year. I can start off. When we started thinking about this, I started thinking, well, I don't think I bought that much stuff. And then looking back, I realized I kind of did. And I think that my favorite purchase is going to have to be a set of three Atari 8-bit computer cartridges. These were a set of three Sega games made in between, I'd say, 83, 84. It was Star Trek and Buck Rogers and Congo Bongo. And I think I had probably all three of these back in the day, but hadn't played any of them in a long, long time. And then I bought these, and it was a good price, and the Star Trek, I realized, was actually a whole lot of fun. It was actually more fun than I even remember. Like, I remembered that, wait, I had that game, and it was pretty fun, but I didn't remember what it was like. But I got it, and I played it, and I was happy to play it. Of course, I could have just actually played it on an emulator instead and had the fun as well. But sometimes I like to just sort of wait. I see something, and I think, oh, that'd be cool. I can buy that. I'm not going to play it and spoil it for myself. I'll wait till I have that crumbling 8-bit cartridge in my hands to try it out for real. So that was my favorite purchase of the year. Earl, how about you? What was your best retro purchase this year?
I didn't buy a whole lot, but I actually did really luck out early in the year. You almost wouldn't call it a purchase because all I had to pay was the cost of shipping. But there was a gentleman getting rid of an industrial-sized collection of software and books and all that retro. And among it was a compiler that I used back in the 80s and made a lot of money with and had a lot of fun with called Clipper. It took code that you would write in the database language DBase, and then it would compile it to an executable. The documentation was great. The product was very featureful and fast, and I loved working with it so much, and I'd been keeping my eyes open for it for years and years and years. And finally, I found it in the inventory of this stuff that this gentleman was getting rid of and nicely enough giving away for free. So I sent off $10 for the shipping and handling, and when I got it, a bonus was that it was actually still new in the shrink wrap, and I haven't even opened it yet. I think I'm going to video it for a little unboxing, and I'm not sure what kind of interest there will be in a 1980s DBase compiler, but I'm going to capture it for posterity. And also, as Paul and Carrington, I think, have mentioned before, when you take something out of the shrink wrap, it's interesting even to see the order in which the documentation was placed in the binder and how things looked when they were brand new. So I'll definitely capture that, and then I'll play around with it, but that's definitely my favorite for the year.
Nice. Very cool. I think I've heard of this Clipper before. I've definitely never used it, but something that I've heard of. So this basically, with this, you could make a ready-to-run DOS executable that would deal with your database for you, basically.
Exactly.
Okay. Cool. All right. That sounds pretty great. I would love to see your Clipper unboxing video. Paul, how about you? What is your favorite purchase of this past year?
Well, I've been as you've all been talking, I've been frantically digging around in my little Evernote, to try to figure out what was this year, what was my favorite, because unfortunately or fortunately, I many things make their way to me, but I think actually the thing that I don't know might be the most impressive is this disk drive that I talked about, I think, a couple times ago. But it was, I think, I'm just trying to remember now what the serial number, but it's like disk 2 number 145, I think, or something, which was really quite something, just to be able to see it. And I think it was one of these things that I just sort of like saw pop up at the top of the eBay list, and then suddenly thought, if I don't get that right now, I'm not going to get, this is going to go immediately. So
right.
It's pretty cool. Yes, here it is. The label says A2M0003-00145. So, and of course, nice. Just for fun, I, compared it to some other ones that are in the, hundreds of thousands that I have elsewhere in my office. So I think that was kind of neat, just sort of as a piece of history,
Sure.
It doesn't have, it's missing some of the, it's missing like the logic board inside, so I can't actually use it, but it's still kind of a neat thing to hold.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, so even if it's not working, it's nice to get something that's got such a low serial number. Not quite back to patient zero, but it's definitely a great find, and when I heard that you'd picked that one up, I was very jealous.
My plan is working.
All right, cool. Well, Michael, besides being jealous of Paul's old disk drive, what did you buy in 2015 that you are especially happy with?
Well, it's Oscar Vermeulen's PyDP 8. Now, when I first heard about this project and saw the first pictures of it, I basically fell in love with it. And as soon as it was available to go as a kit, I was basically in there. And the best part about buying this is that I still haven't got around to making it, so it's probably going to turn into, hopefully, my favorite project of 2016 when I actually do manage to take it out of its drawer and start working on it and to get it all done. And we'll talk a bit more about Oscar's PyDP 8 later, but it is, again, a superb piece of kit, a wonderful project, and I'm looking forward to assembling it soon.
Excellent. That is one of those things that when you haven't yet assembled it, you still have the thing, like, you have that in front of you to, like, look forward to.
Mm.
And, like, and then after you've done it, you kind of have the disappointment, perhaps, of saying, oh, well, there it is. What's the next thing? But I'm sure though, once you do and set it up, I'm sure it's very, very cool. I unfortunately did not buy one, but I might still get one someday because it looks very cool. And I loved messing around with the PDP-8E that we had in college. So, all right, good. Let's move on to some listener feedback. Tony pointed out to us the C64 Preservation Project, which has been around for quite a while, and the recent posting of the 10th Anniversary Collection on archive.org. I'm not really familiar with this project. I think the goal of the project was to archive original versions of Commodore 64 software, but it seems like the actual distribution of this collection was kind of limited in some way. But now it's been put onto archive.org, so it's all right there. So the entire collection is there with approximately a boatload of software. I'm not sure the size of the boat that it would fill, but a sizable boat.
1 metric bit ton, I think, is the official measurement.
Yeah, it really looks quite involved. I mean, you know, like I see this kind of preservation effort, you know, in the Apple community. Like I haven't looked to see kind of what goes on in the other communities, but this is really quite neat. There's a database of how things are protected, and the thing that went on archive.org is, you know, is the result of this. Although I think through the site itself, from what I understood was you basically send images to the site, and then they just are, you know, that they're there somehow at the site, but you can't get them back out. So the archive.org link is a nice one to actually sort of give access to the public without the kind of liability that might go along with it if it were on the actual C64 preservation site.
Okay. Anyway, it seems very cool. So if you need to stock up on disk images for your C64 emulator, you can grab things there, and I'm sure almost anything you want is probably in there, which is cool. We also had Joaquin, who wrote in with an article about bringing up a web server on a 1992 Spark Classic. And one of the interesting things about this article is that the article itself is actually from 2004. So it's actually an old, old article about an even older, older computer. In fact, the computer was not much older at the time than that article is now. It would be interesting to know if the guy who did this can still run his Spark Classic. And it seemed to be, at least at the time, a dozen years later, he was able to pretty much get things up and running. He even got Java up and running, although decided in the long run not to continue with it because it was taking up too much RAM to do what he wanted to do. I don't know. What did you guys think about this? Paul, I think you had some thoughts about this article.
Yeah, no, it was just, you know, it's kind of a detailing, in relatively short form, but detailing what it took to get an Apache web server up and running, and, you know, on this machine that was at that time fairly old. And it just kind of led me to wonder what happens, you know, like, could you do that now? Like, I wonder if you actually could, or if this is, this kind of retro experiment is already itself kind of like a retro thing. That I think we were talking last time about the you know, the difficulties with getting on the network and stuff, and the increasing difficulties with encryption and all that that's kind of required now. So I wonder if this could even be replicated, or if this is a little time capsule of its own.
Right. I guess I would tend to think that, like, a Unix workstation from the early 90s could be brought up to snuff to do fairly decent stuff today. I think the trickiest thing would be that all the software that is written nowadays is built around newer versions of compilers and libraries and frameworks that would all have to be in some way backported to an old OS to run on these things. But I don't know. I think, like we were talking before about, like, especially 8-bit computers and how it get those things working on a network properly. Like, it's a Sun Spark Station is a different beast. I mean, that's very much built around working on a network, but I'm sure it'd be more challenging now to get modern stuff running on that old machine than it was a decade ago.
I'll say that if you were running an older version of Solaris, then yeah, maybe you'd bump into a problem. I think there are Spark versions of Linux, right? And probably you could get a fairly modern version of Linux for Spark to run on this. And if you did that, some of the newer frameworks actually tend to be lightweight and are meant to be like that. So maybe getting a fully loaded heavy Apache with Java or something like that wouldn't be the way you'd go. You might go with something like Node.js that has a much lighter footprint, and I bet you could do it.
Yep, probably so. Interesting. Okay, and the another piece of feedback, we got a link sent to us of a short interview with Tom Persky, who is the president of floppydisk.com. It's a very interesting and quick view about this company that just gathers and repurposes old floppy disks. I think they both have, I think they seem to have sort of in storage a lot of floppy disks that were, are still sort of new in box. And they're also collecting disks from other sources since these are not being manufactured anymore, but there are still people who want to use them. And not just people, but also companies, governments, bigger companies, all sorts of things. So very interesting, quick little view.
He mentioned avionics, and that kind of scared me.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess there's probably a lot of, you know, equipment mounted inside of airplanes that is updatable via a floppy disk. You know, things that were built in the 80s or 90s and weren't thinking of, hey, let's have this thing talk to a web server to pull down the latest driver versions or whatever. They pop in a floppy, I guess. And yeah, it does seem sort of iffy because, like, what if that thing, hopefully the software that reads off those floppies has some proper checksums and that sort of thing for the data it's pulling in, but you never know.
Fingers crossed.
Yep. Think about that next time you're flying. All right, let's move on to the items of interest that we have here. Earl, you have a very interesting one that I had also glanced at before about an interesting application of Tetris.
Yes, on the, it's called the DevDef blog on blogspot.nl, you can find what is now an 11-part tutorial on building Tetris on the Commodore 64, kind of going from scratch and building it with 6502 assembler. And so I think it's a tutorial series that captures a variety of things, not just 6502 assembler in isolation, but how you would do it on a Commodore 64 and take advantage of the various hardware components available to you. It looks like a really good series, and I actually would like to go through it myself, and I think it's something that I'm going to make time to do. And I just wanted to point it out for folks. Not only is the material covered, but also one possible tool chain that you could use. I believe the Sublime Editor is used in this case with a plugin for a specific 6502 assembler on the Commodore 64 called the Kick Assembler. Mm-hmm. And so this kind of bootstraps you all the way along. It's like, here are the tools you could use. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to do it. And like I say, now we're up to 11 parts. So if you're interested in thus and such, then you could find a link for this on our show notes.
Very cool. I think it's always nice to see someone give a demonstration of how things are done from the ground up. It's more difficult to look at a piece of source code that is done and say, here we go. Get started trying to pile through this thing. But whereas someone is sort of building it block by block, Tetris style, then it's a little bit easier to follow along. Michael, you're up next. You have a very interesting Commodore 64 project, another one. We're on our C64 theme here for the moment.
Yeah, this one is part of how I really love what's happening in the retro computer community at the moment, is the building of new interface hardware to go with our beloved old machines. And in this case here, it's a Wi-Fi modem for your Commodore 64. Now, we'll include a link to a video, and it's a very interesting 21 minute video going through the actual board itself, connecting it up, configuring it, and using it. And what I love about this is that it's basically getting cables off the desk. So if you want to hook your machine up to a Wi-Fi hotspot off your phone or the Wi-Fi router that's in the house or the office, you can now hook up your Commodore 64 and get online with that, which is so much more satisfying than a $15 or $20 cable, null modem cable back to your computer. But, yep, they're expecting that it's going to be going for about $150 US. Pre-orders are being taken right now. So there's a link to the forum for this. So, guys, what's your thoughts on a Wi-Fi modem for a Commodore 64?
I think this is something that everybody should want to have, maybe. No, like I think definitely if I was into doing Commodore stuff, I mean, I'm always a fan of eliminating cables where you can. So, sure, why not? It would make it easier to, you know, say you want to lug your Commodore into the family room to hook up to the TV to mess with, and not have to run a cable to your computer to do something else you're doing interesting with it. So, sure. Kind of pricey though, but could be worth it.
We were spending that kind of money, or up to that kind of money, for new hardware back in the day. So I look at it this way, allowing for inflation, it's actually quite cheap. He says, trying to justify his own purchases. But the best part about this video is that he takes his Commodore 64, his Wi-Fi modem, and pops down to the local internet cafe and hops in there and hooks up, and away it goes. So it's just giving you that added portability for your Commodore 64, and you too can go down and enjoy a nice hot cup of coffee and do some web surfing on your Commodore.
Perfect. Oh, does it work with the what was the C64 model that was the sort of portable, luggable device?
Yeah, I was just wondering about that myself. It's the SX64, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that what he brought to the cafe?
No, he takes his Commodore 64, as in the bread box.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah.
A little portable CRT, portable LCD composite monitor, and hooks it all up, and away it goes. But no, it's good to see this kind of development work out there. And I believe that they were hoping to have had this ready for World of Commodore, which has just been on. But any word from Carrington? I believe Carrington, being the Commodore enthusiast that he is, would possibly have been popping into World of Commodore.
I think there was a restraining order.
I think that might just be a rumor.
All right. Well, we'll see. We'll hear. So I think we'll get to hear from Carrington next time, and perhaps he can tell us about his Commodore World adventures. But in the meantime, Paul, tell us about the Infocom cabinet.
Well, okay. So this is I think is a really quite interesting thing that happened recently. So Jason Scott had a whole, or actually I believe that this was really Steve Moretzky's stuff from the early, you know, throughout Infocom. And so Steve had collected, actually very meticulously apparently, all the like news clippings and memos and design notes and stuff for the games that he and other people were involved in making. And then, so Jason has just gone through and dumped all of this stuff onto archive.org. So he's got a blog post that kind of introduces this, called A Cabinet of Infocom Curiosities, and, you know, with pictures of all the stuff that got scanned. And there is a follow-up post also that's called The Rest of the Infocom Cabinet, which is sort of outlining some of the non-game design related stuff, like Infocom memos and, you know, like, I don't know, things and scheduling the softball games and that sort of stuff. But so it's huge, and it's really quite interesting. I know the Infocom, access to some of the Infocom materials has had a little bit of a story behind it, because which actually, if you were to go to the Open Apple podcast, Jason Scott talked about this in May and number 47 there, but it basically just has to do with Jason getting a hold of a hard drive. I mean, like, he was given a hard drive from the early Infocom days, and you know, sort of sent a copy off for safekeeping that wound up getting out in a way that wasn't intended. And so there's it's nice that this stuff is coming, you know, is now back out. But the, you know, some of the problem with the sort of earlier drama with the Infocom data is that it contained things like emails and stuff like that that were, you know, it didn't cast people in good lights, you know, and mm-hmm. You know, just sort of internal office politics that is still, you know, not quite something that you necessarily want to have out there in the world. But I've taken a look at the actual archive itself on archive.org a little bit. I mean, I did probably what almost everybody did, which is like, you know, okay, let's see the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy notes. And it's cool. I mean, you know, there's a couple of letters from Douglas Adams talking about you know, ideas they have for the game, and this sort of goes through, there's little maps and there's little memos with the people who were making the box art, and you know, complaints about how I think at one point there was supposed to be, I think there was a mock-up photo on the box, and inside the box, you know, Infocom is known for all these feelies, and there was a sort of a paired set of notices. One of them is the notice that was served to Arthur Dent about like his house being bulldozed over, and then one is a notice in like some sort of alien language, but it's clearly the same kind of thing about Earth having to be like moved due to the whatever it is, the super space bypass or whatever it is that's supposed to go there, right. And so the alien one is written in this alien language, but from what I could detect in the memo, there was apparently the art department had I don't know, their mock-up of it was clear enough that you could tell that it wasn't actually, it was sort of like readable text or something. And so there was a sort of irate seeming little memo about how, you know, this would be very unprofessional. We need to have this fixed. And so anyway, it's interesting to see the history in there, and it will take forever to look through it, but it's excellent that it's there.
Right. Very cool. Yeah. I think there's, you know, that company produced so much stuff that so many of us have good memories from, that it's interesting to be able to look at the process behind how some of these things came to be and what was going on behind the scenes. So a very cool archive of stuff there. I'm going to talk about one thing that happened, I think it was it just last week or was it the week before?
Yep.
It was the week before. The Raspberry Pi Zero came out. This is the latest Raspberry Pi device. 40% faster than the original Raspberry Pi, and very, very tiny, and just $5. And it sold out immediately, of course. I think it sold out the same day. I know that it sold out the same day that I saw it anyway. I think it was like on a Thursday, and I looked later in the evening, and it was already gone. Apparently, it was also sold as a pack-in on a magazine sold in the UK. It's either called Magpie or Pi Mag. I forget.
Yeah, Magpie.
And Magpie. I asked some colleagues in the UK to see if they could nab me a copy, but that did not seem to succeed either, unfortunately. But I'm sure there'll be more later. Anyway, it seems very, very cool just because it's, again, faster than ever before, tinier than ever before, cheaper than ever before. Okay, not faster than the latest one, but faster than the original anyway. So I think it's a very interesting and promising device. And it occurs to me that not that long ago, I think we had an item about a $9 computer someone was trying to make a Kickstarter for. And that thing was probably more underpowered than this device is, and this thing has probably beat them to the punch. So I think it's really insane to think about how fast things are progressing at this point, but it's very, very cool.
Yeah, just on the previous episode, we had this discussion about the Code Bug, I think it's called, you know, so this little mm-hmm. little device which costs quite a bit more than this and is much less powerful. So
yep, pretty wild.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to get my hands on a couple of these. I've got a few ideas for them, and basically, it's the size or the lack of the size that's really got me interested, because it brings up a whole new look at where can I fit one of these inside the case of my computer mm-hmm. to use it as an ancillary device. I don't need to have it plugged in on the outside. You know, if your machine's got space inside, and you can pick up the 5 volts to run it. It's probably only going to be a small soldering exercise just to make an adapter, pick that up, and run with it. So I'm really looking forward to getting. I can probably would want to get maybe 3 or 4 of these just so that I can try out different things. And unlike previous Raspberry Pi projects where you repurpose them for different things, with this, it's to me, it's a case of set it up once and it just becomes that dedicated device.
Yeah, it's so cheap you can afford to assign it to some task and let it be that thing forever.
Forever, yeah. Yeah, just put a little SD card in there, load it up, and let it loose.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's the... So one of the... I've seen some critiques of this talking about, you know, how well... You know, they say it's cheap, but you need an adapter for the... You know, there's only one USB plug, so you need a hub, and you need the mini HDMI adapter and a power adapter and all this stuff. But I think, you know, so for the purpose of, like... getting this as a student learning about computers, yeah, you probably do have to spend more than $5 to kind of get going on this. But for something like if I wanted to run a file server or something like that, you know, it's nice to be able to have this and not have to try to work around all those extra, you know, the composite out and all these other things that are in the bigger one. So, yeah, I definitely would be interested in getting a couple.
Yeah, I don't even sort of consider the lack of the pins on the GPIO as a problem, because I'm probably not going to be using most of them, and I would just basically create some 90-degree bent-over pins, get them in place, and then just connect in single wires onto them and just run what I need. So yeah, it's amazing what you can actually do with it. And yeah, okay, it's got one USB, so while you're developing it, but when I was just setting up down here this morning, I was pushing aside, you know, several little USB hubs, and I've got all the pieces, peripheral pieces that I would need just to hook it up to do the development work. And but once it's all done, that's it. It's going to run headless. It's going to just no longer be in sight. It's going to have a job to do, and I'm just going to let it go at it.
Yep. So I'm excited about this. I don't know when there will be more of them available, but hopefully not too long. Moving along, another interesting inexpensive computer. Not quite as inexpensive as this, but still very interesting. Earl, you have something to tell us about.
I do. Part of what excites me about these low-cost computing platforms is the idea of using them, like Michael was saying, as an enhancement to our retro computer collection. You could use it as a peripheral of different kinds. The one that I want to talk about this time, there's a Kickstarter for this. It's called the Latte Panda, and it'll cost about $80. It's a Windows 10 computer. It's got a quad-core Atom processor, 2 gigs of RAM, 32 gigs of flash, and they even slapped an Arduino-compatible coprocessor on here in case you want to do some Arduino-type things. You've got that circuitry built right on board. It's got Bluetooth. It's got Wi-Fi. It's fully connected, and it's smaller than an iPhone. So this shows me, this along with the Raspberry Pi Zero, which I think will be a great embedded device, just set it and forget it. You know, do what you want to do with it, and you could dedicate it to a single use, and at $5 plus an SD card, you can't lose, right? For me, this shows that the excitement of the electronic and maker movements are really in full swing right now. So if this project sees the light of day, it'll be interesting to see how it could be used as a retro enhancement. And if you think, well, $80 might be quite a bit to dedicate to a retro project, I mean, just a few minutes ago we were talking about a $150 device that would be a Wi-Fi modem for your Commodore 64. So $80 for a full system that you could just use for one or two purposes doesn't seem that crazy. And we'll have a link to this in the show notes as well. And so I like to compare this maker movement, electronics movement, to the computer movement of the 70s and 80s, because there's so much in common between those two time frames. And I love seeing this excitement come back. In fact, I think in, I don't know, an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, they're going to blast some Raspberry Pis into outer space on a United Launch Alliance rocket, unless that launch got scrubbed. I don't know. They've been having trouble with the weather. But if I check my Twitter feed here, I see that, yeah, over the 30-minute time period, there's going to be five different opportunities for this Atlas V rocket to blast some Raspberry Pis into outer space. So there they go. We're taking Raspberry Pis where no man has gone before.
Awesome. Yeah, I agree. It's very exciting to see these new relatively low powered but very inexpensive and very small devices that are appearing, and relatively low powered compared to what we have on our desktops, but otherwise compared to the kind of stuff we're usually talking about, extremely powerful things, really.
It's astounding to me that this is running Windows 10. I mean, so one of the things that occurred to me as Earl was saying this is that, you know, we were talking about $150 wireless thing, but, and it almost feels like heresy or something to take this like whole Windows 10 box and just like turn it into something that, you know, communicates over Bluetooth, but it's got the ability, right? So I wonder, I mean, that's one of the things I was kind of excited about the Raspberry Pi Zero 2 about, is that you can imagine now it's a little bit like the FPGA boards or whatever, where you could sort of like just download a peripheral. I mean, like just the little plans of like these are the GPIO pins that you connect, and here's an SD image, and now you have, just plug this thing into your whatever retro computer, and you have a wireless connection, or you have something like that. So, very cool.
Yep, cool. These are exciting times.
I'm looking forward to the Arduino support that this has got as well. That's not only are we going to have a full, sort of full-featured Windows 10 machine, but just the connectivity that's going to be available on it if this does eventuate. And after this show, I'm going to be clicking onto that Kickstarter and putting my pledge in.
Yep. Cool. Very nice. Let's move on to the next thing here. Michael, you have a bit of news about RCR itself.
Yes. We are now on Facebook, folks. So if you want to pop over to just search for Retro Computing Roundtable and click on the join, and it's going to just be another avenue for us to post up when shows are available. And we've gone with the group style rather than just the like page, so specifically so that listeners can actually pop in, they can start a thread, they can comment on it, which is things which I think are much more important to do than just having a page where we can tell people what's happening and put information out there. It's a way for our listeners to additionally participate in the show, give us ideas, and just have retro computing related discussions. So pop on over and join us.
Yep, I think it's really a really great avenue to be able to talk to people a little bit more directly and in a forum that people are pretty comfortable with. So thank you, Michael, for setting that up, and everyone should get on there and take a look. Paul, you have some fantastic thing that I had never heard of, but I was pretty excited to read about, the Telharmonium. Please tell us about the Telharmonium.
Yeah, this thing is pretty wild, actually. So it's a relatively recently published article on Atlas Obscura, but it's referring to an article from, what is this, McClure's? Yeah, McClure's magazine from July 1906. And the article is called "New Music for an Old World: Dr. Thaddeus Cahill's Dynamophone, an extraordinary electrical invention for producing scientifically perfect music." And so what this basically details is this big mechanical invention. So it's not actually computing related at all, but it still feels like it's in the same kind of world, that essentially would synthesize music in one location and then stream it over telephone wires to subscribers, basically. You know, these would be like restaurants and things like that. And this was actually, it was before there was, I don't even know how this is possible, but it was basically before there was an amplifier available. So they had to send it down the wires at some kind of like high power, which was itself kind of an engineering problem, because they, you know, if they get another, you know, some number of thousand subscribers, they have to build another power plant. But it was actually, they have really kind of neat photos in here of the machine, and this was actually, it was really sort of a way of broadcasting, in a sense, music that was played that was human produced. So they have a couple of pictures of a couple of people at the keyboard producing these things, and it really was quite an interesting thing. And just the idea that it was so long ago, you know, that this is early 1900s, it's just quite something. So definitely worth reading and just sort of thinking about.
One of the things that I liked was they were sort of comparing this to Spotify. The title of the article says this was the Spotify of 1906. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I think, you know, I mean, obviously looking back, this is before there was even radio for home users. So this must have been totally revolutionary to be able to have some way that you could, and unlike radio, that you could sort of just like, it's there or it's not. Like, this is actually, you could get it on demand, in a sense. You couldn't get what you wanted on demand. Like, there was probably only one stream. Like, there was just like a thing going all the time, but pretty interesting. And the thing that I'm most missing is I would love to hear what it sounded like, because the way people are describing it, they're describing that it sounds like a, I don't have any quotes in front of me, but like that it was just something almost miraculous, that like you had never heard anything like it before. And I guess probably, sure, they'd never heard an electronic synthesizer. And I guess this is kind of a precursor to the synthesizer that came around later. But it would be really interesting to hear what this thing actually sounded like, which I guess we probably never will. But very, very cool. Michael, back to you. You had some more news about the Pi DP8.
Yes. Oscar Vermeulen basically was giving a presentation at the Hackaday Super Conference, and we'll provide a link both to the video and also to the page itself. But it's just covering again his journey of creating this as a kit, also some of his earlier work, and he covers the pitfalls of sometimes that cheapest components are not always the most cost-effective components, which I think all of us have experienced somewhat over time, sort of thinking, oh, we'll just get these pieces, you know, you can't knock it back on the price, but you end up having to get something different anyway. But it's a great article and an excellent video presentation on the Pi DP8. And what really got me is the little throwaway at the end of the article, that over 1,000 Pi DP8 kits have been sold. So I'm wondering, how many of those are like mine, still sitting there waiting for their purchaser to find the time to spread the parts out and to sit down and put it all together? Or am I just one of the few who just haven't found the time, and that there are hundreds and hundreds of these Pi DP8s that are just calling out for mine to join them? But no, it's a great article. More great pictures of the Pi DP8 itself. So if you haven't seen one, pop over, have a look at the Pi DP8, and then watch the video. It's great.
Cool. Yeah, I think like anything, most things we talk about, it's always good to sort of see the process or hear about how someone came up with something and their kind of adventure leading them to produce something. So this looks like a good thing to watch. I've not yet watched this video, but I'm going to take a look.
I think that is super impressive, actually, though, that there have been 1,000. I mean, like, I had no idea. I assumed that probably like 48 of these had been sold. You know, it's great. It's great that you know, that these are so appreciated, because I mean, they really are beautiful. But I really just did not know until today just how big of a project that must have been, and still is. I mean, I think he was saying something like he still has, it's either four or six, like half of them still left to ship. It's amazing.
Pretty wild. I'm going to guess, though, that, Paul, your guess of 48 sold, that's probably closer to the number that are actually built.
I hope not. I mean, I honestly, seeing this makes me feel really kind of bad about not having hurried up and, like, put it together. Because, I mean, you know, like, a lot of work went into bringing it to me.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little bit guilty that when I saw the posting and went and watched the video, that I went out to my workroom and opened up the drawer where I've kept this with a few other bits and pieces for that project, and just basically unwrapped it and had a look at it and then wrapped it up and closed the drawer. I've got to dedicate some serious time.
So what I'm hearing now is that at this point in our little group, we are 0-2. If we extrapolate this out to everybody, that means that actually no one has built this. It's only Oscar's built it. Has anyone seen any photos of any of these actually constructed in the wild? Or is it just Oscar? Poor Oscar.
Yeah. No, he has featured a couple of, I think when some people have sent him sort of like build photos. So I think there are probably, you know, half a dozen out there that way you can see photos of having been built.
Okay. That's a relief. Not everyone is as lazy as us. Yeah. That's good. All right. Moving along, it's time for a word from our sponsor. Commodore, bringing you the new Commodore Plus 4.
Yeah, this Commodore stuff's so interesting that maybe we should do a Commodore podcast as well.
I think I know someone who's doing one of those.
Mm.
What's that?
I hope we're not stealing all their material.
All right, let's pick this up again. And
announcing a fabulous sale on the Commodore Plus 4 personal computer, the first computer with 4 built-in software packages, the big 4 every computer owner needs, built-in graphics and sound commands, 128 colors, 64K memory, 75 commands, word processing for letters, reports, create graphics, graphs, charts, full color designs, balance checkbooks, business statements, income tax, file management for mailing lists, inventories, recipes. Retailers originally sold the Commodore Plus 4 for $299.95. Now it's yours for only $99.95 complete. We'll include $150 in discount coupons towards special options. Use your credit card and order the incredible Commodore Plus 4, the $99.95 computer package you've been waiting for.
Use your credit card for rush delivery by calling 1-800-441-1234. Or send check or money order for $99.95 plus $10 shipping and handling to Commodore Plus 4. PO Box 3500, Department A, West Caldwell.
And we're back. It's time to move along to the retro computing gift idea. And I've got one that is quite a doozy, in my opinion. This is something called the Pixel Vision. It is a handcrafted, handheld video game emulator. Runs, of course, on a Raspberry Pi, as all these things do nowadays. Now, the nice thing is it's like handcrafted wooden device made by a guy here in Sweden who he's got a Kickstarter going for this. The Kickstarter goal has been met, so this is going to happen. The only downside, and it's a small downside, is that the device itself costs about 4,000 Swedish crowns, which is $470. Pretty pricey, but it's a very cool looking little thing. It kind of folds in half, kind of like a Nintendo Game Boy DS, but when you fold it in half, it looks just like a little tiny wooden box. And it has some nice features. So the screen is a little LCD or LED screen, but using some OpenGL rendering tricks, it's got a little curvature to it, so it looks like you're playing on an old CRT, an old tiny CRT. But it looks pretty interesting, and if anybody wants to send me one for Christmas, I'll be happy. I don't know if I'll buy one myself, though, because it is pricey, but it looks very, very cool. And just scrolling through the article, there's a lot of nice shots of what the box itself looks like, including this wooden hinged thing, which is pretty fantastic.
Yeah, it looks beautiful.
Yep, it looks very nice. And the first batch is supposed to be going out in January, and the second batch is probably in March, and they're all available now. There are two sort of models. Like, there's the base model that is 4,000 crowns, and there's the, what's it called, the Pearl model that I think costs 6,000 or 7,000 crowns, which has just like sort of nicer chrome, nicer buttons and things. So, pretty wild. Yep. That's what I think you should get for the retro computing fan in your life. Let's move on to our eBay auctions. Paul, you have one or more items to share with us. What would you like to share with us today?
Well, let's see. I have a rather miscellaneous bunch of items. But so the first one is a Hero robot. And so I think it probably a couple times ago I pointed out a relatively nice Hero set. But this Hero 1. But I've never. I don't think I've seen one this complete. This is really quite a nice auction. It's got it's missing a power supply, but it has the Hero robot itself, and looks all intact. Looks like all the side panels are there. It has a lot of documentation. Doesn't look like it was stored in a barn. And there's an extra arm, so it's really quite something. So it's starting bid is $400. It to me would be $100 in shipping, and there is a single bid on it, and it probably should still be going by the time this gets out. So it's 6 days from when we're recording. So it's neat to look at if you like looking at Hero 1 robots.
Yeah, I remember hearing of this. I never have used one or seen one in real life, but I kind of this is something that I remember that I was aware of back in the day, and it seems like. If this all still works, I mean, it's pricey for what it is in some ways, but if it works, then maybe it's not too bad. Because it's certainly not a common item, I would say, at this point.
Yeah, no, yeah, they definitely aren't. Usually they're quite rare. They go for quite a lot if you can find them. And almost everyone that I've seen, there's something wrong with it. The arm's broken or it's missing a panel This really is quite a nice setup. But again, I don't know. I'm not sure exactly. I think last time I talked about this, I still have the same problem as then, that I don't have any floor space. So I don't know where it would go. But so I was going to link to an eBay auction for a Commodore Educator 64. And so I put it in last night, in the show notes, and it came back this morning, and it was gone, because it sold for something under $300, which I think probably, I guess I'm not too surprised that it sold right away, because I think this one is a pretty rare thing. I'm not super well versed in the Commodore line, but this appears to be, if I'm not mistaken, basically a 64 inside a PET case. So that sounds about right, Earl.
That is right. Sorry, I was fumbling for the mute button. That's the one. And so it's a weird kind of hybrid machine, and I've only seen one ever in person. But, pretty cool and collectible.
Yeah, it seems like it would be, possibly like a more... Like, I like the PET shape, but the relative power of the 64 would be nice. So anyway, you can't buy that, but you can look at the pictures. It was already sold. I did find a license plate that is being sold. It says TI-99er and has September 85 tags. So that'll come in handy. I think that's about it. Did I have anything else? Oh, yeah, I guess there was one more. So maybe one thing left that's even a little bit serious is... Commodore data set. Very Commodore heavy, it's true, this time. But so this is an old style cassette recorder for, I think this is probably the PET era. It's black, so it's earlier than the ones I've seen, either for the VIC 20 or for the C64. So it's kind of neat insofar as it is one of the earlier models. It says that in the description that the record key doesn't work. You can't put down record in combination with play like you would normally need to in order to record onto it. I do kind of wonder, though, thinking back on my own experiences with these machines, not the Commodore ones, but just the cassette decks, is that often that is the symptom of having the write protect notch out. So if I know that I remember, sort of putting in the, pushing in the little... tab thing, the detector in the back, and then that'll allow record and play to go down. I can't remember why I was doing that. I think it was so that I could get the microphone signal to go, go from microphone in to audio out without actually bothering to record. I was using it as some sort of, adapter.
Yeah, that does sound like that also, because like all those things were such, they had that kind of interlock there that if you had no tape in or had a tape with the notch pushed out, you could never press the record button down. So that's probably, it's probably actually fine. It's probably just that. But yeah, I feel like I don't recognize this device exactly or the connectors. I don't know what, I guess this is for a pet, but I don't really know. All right, cool. Let's move along. Earl, you have something pretty nice looking here.
Yeah, it's an Apple III Plus. It's only $50 and zero bids right now. Now, a couple of downsides to this potentially. First off, I'll say it's the whole thing. You got the Apple III, you got the monitor, and they say it works, but I don't know because they don't show it working. But for $50. That seems like a really good deal. Of course, if the bids went way up, then I don't know. Even if you had to do some repair work on it for $50, that would be a pretty good deal. It's pretty dirty looking. It looks kind of beat up. And so it would take a non-trivial cleaning, and I'm not sure what of the dirt on it is permanent versus what might be able to be cleaned off. But again, you know, sometimes with some elbow grease, you can do wonders with these things. Another potential downside for folks thinking about this, it's only for free local pickup, but it's in Seattle, Washington. So if I wanted to bid on this, I could just take a short drive up to Skedaddle and pick it up. So I'm actually thinking about this. I would really like to have an Apple III. And, you know, I've got a friend or two that have some Apple III experience. One of them's podcasting with me right now. So that's my auction pick. And it's got a little over, almost 7 days left on it. So it might still be there by the time the podcast airs.
Yeah, this does look nice. It's true that I don't know to what extent they tested it. When they say that it works, we might be looking at it. You know, the monitor goes green if you don't plug any video signal into it. But
yeah, I'm trying to, in the picture of the monitor going, I'm just trying to like make out, you know, what might be screen burn-in or what's actually, there's something, looks like something trying to be displayed there in the background.
Looks like Visicalc to me. But yeah, I mean, I think the monitor is not the super important part, although this is a monitor that's the kind of, it goes with the 3 Plus, like the coloring on it. These monitors, even though they have the same part number, there were different colors basically to this front bezel, and this gray one is the one that goes with the 3 Plus. The other thing I was going to say about the 3 Plus, so these are super rare. There's unless nobody notices this, there's no way this is going to go for $50, I think, but the free local pickup will, I think, reduce the competition for it. But one thing that's kind of nice about this is they didn't sell very many because the thing came out basically about when they shut down the line. But my thinking at least is that they should be more reliable. I mean, you know, whatever problems the original three had, this one doesn't, right? You know, so it should last longer. Has an actual delete key as well. You know, some various other things. So this is a It would be nice to have this. Anyone in Seattle should get it unless Earl wants it.
That's the criteria. Only buy things that we don't want to have.
Oh, I don't talk about the things that I'm going to buy.
Oh, is that the trick? Yeah. Commodore, I'm giving away all the good stuff. All right. Moving along, here's something that I found that I'm not going to buy. But it's interesting. So it's an Atari 800, which is not that interesting in and of itself. I mean, everyone has seen these. This one seems to be actually in pretty nice shape by the look of it. It's not dirty. It's not got a lot of yellowing problems going on. It's fully decked out with 48K of RAM. It does have one weird note in the text. It says, "The bottom of the computer is quite strange. Seems to have melted somehow. The original owner may be... put the computer over a hot surface. The damage did not affect the motherboard, which is operating perfectly." And actually, if you scroll through the attached pictures, there is a picture that shows the bottom, which is weird looking.
Wow.
It's got some weird melting stuff going on. And besides being weirdly melted, seems to have a piece of blue fabric covered with white flowers that has been apparently glued to the bottom of the entire non-vent portion of the device, I guess to cover up some horrible blackened burn from wherever this thing was sitting on. It's quite interesting. And then on top of the fabric, there's a handwritten sticker label saying what this is. It's the model number Atari 800, and also pointing out the name of the guy who I guess is responsible for this monstrosity. But the most fascinating thing about all of this is the price of this item. This is selling, and I know that everyone has probably come across these on eBay or whatever. Anyone's looking at Atari stuff, they come up all the time. This one, with the special melted bottom, costs 275 British pounds, which in my reckoning is $415. It's incredibly expensive for just a computer that is also melted on the bottom. And I just...
It's a deal at any price.
but how many Ataris have you seen with a floral print?
I could do that myself. So
that would be homebrew. That'd be homebrew, man.
Well, anyway, someone else go. Feel free to buy that. And it's actually not an auction. It's actually just got to buy it now price, with no offer button. So it's £275 or no deal.
Take it or leave it.
Take it or leave it. And I say leave it. All right. Anybody else want to say anything about this thing?
It is a nice floral print.
Yeah. Yeah, it was when I was looking through the looking for things for today's show, and I came across one thing which I had initially discarded, but you know, since we were talking about the overpriced Atari, one of the things I came across was a vintage Timex Sinclair 1000 personal computer with, and, you know, it's in the box and it has some tapes and some books and stuff. $2,000, buy it now. And I thought, yes, there is a make offer, so presumably that's actually what is being. You know, that's really how it's being sold, unless some crazy person decided that they wanted to spend $2,000 on a computer that, like, was supposed to be a cheap computer from the outset. But
right.
Anyway,
yep, I might go looking for an Atari instead.
Yep. All right. Good. Let's move along then, off the overpriced stuff. Michael, what do you have for us?
Okay. Well, this is definitely not in the overpriced. In the past, I've shown the Matra Alice series computers, which are a Tandy MC10. I suppose a clone might be the way to describe it, but it was an official clone. But here is an actual MC10. It looks in very good condition. It's comes with the box and everything that you need in it. It's buy it now, $50 US. Now, this is one of the lesser, I shouldn't say unpopular, TRS-80 color computers. It is a nice basic little machine. It was released in 83, I believe, and just something to hook up to the TV and for the kids to get going in computing. My apologies, I said there's manuals. It's just the original box. There's no manuals. But it's a nice device. I've also included a link to one of the Matra Alice computers. This is a Series 90 machine, so it's got a little bit more flair on it, a little bit more of a out-there design. But the original Matra Alice is really just a red, almost a red version of the MC10. So just thought I'd put it out there. Some of the more interesting computers that a lot of people don't really look into, or I haven't seen in their collections.
But the Alice looks like it has a much nicer keyboard than the MC10. I actually had an MC10. I did wind up selling it, but the tiny little keyboard was difficult to work around. Whereas the Alice looks like it's got bigger size keys.
It is a proper size keyboard on the Matra Alice. Yeah, I must admit the MC10 was really up there in the unusable keyboard department. But no, it was very similar. You had the similar sorts of keyboards on other machines. It was a way of trying to reduce the manufacturing cost and to make the machine as compact as it could be in the day. As far as using a MC10, I'd personally would rather use the Matra Alice, but for $50 in the box, it's a nice little buy.
Cool.
Yep. Nice. I really like the look of the Alice computer, by the way. It's unusual you see a computer that whose shape is an irregular hexagon.
Yeah. It looks like you should be somehow fitting them together in some kind of puzzle.
Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah, the other Matra Alice models aren't quite as out there.
Okay.
By the way, I think these came up maybe an episode or two ago, but there's a pretty nice blog about programming on the MC10 by Jim Jerry, I think is how you would pronounce it, Gerrie. And there's also a pretty large library of basic programs and games and things that he has screenshots of, and you can download. So if you wind up with an MC10 or an Alice 90, then this is one thing you can do with it.
Yep.
So I have one of these MC10s, and also you can get a 16K, I think it is, but is it some kind of a RAM expander to go in the back as well? And from what I understand, there's not very much space if you don't have one of those expanders.
That's true.
No, it's definitely that's one of the must-have peripherals.
All right, cool. Well, that gets us to the end of our eBay auctions, and it's time to almost wrap it up. That's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this show and all episodes of this show at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss it in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. And now, new for this time, you can join our Facebook group. Just get on Facebook and search for Retro Computing Roundtable.
Woohoo!
Facebook for the win. And you can send feedback, as always, via email to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a proud member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, where you can find other sorts of retro podcasts along the lines of ours. And as always, please, please write a nice review on iTunes or any other way you may be happening to listening to our podcast, because every time you write a nice review, one of us gets a magical pat on the back. I'm not going to tell you which one, though. Until next time,
Retro Compute.